This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. This week, we're going to take a very prominent monster who has written a fascinating autobiography, a book that a lot of people initially did not want to read because they were so horrified by all the things that this man has done over the course of a long life. But it actually turns out to be, as I argue in a review in The Nation, a fascinating document. It's almost as if Dracula or the Frankenstein monster were cognizant enough to write a fairly candid autobiography of their deeds. And as such, is a great topic to write about. My review was very lengthy because it's such a rich subject, and also to talk about. I'm talking, of course, of Marty Peretz and his autobiography from last year, The Controversialist. Peretz is most known as the publisher for many decades of The New Republic from the 74, off and on the early part of the century, where he took on a diminished role. Now, and he's, we'll get into like all the things he's done, but he's been a major figure in American politics and culture for many decades, a key figure in pushing the Democratic Party to the right, a key advocate of what we can broadly call neoliberalism, and someone who, by his own account, has been responsible for some of the worst and most horrific political decisions of the last few decades, ranging from the kind of deregulation and financialization of the economy that led to the 2008 meltdown, to the support of the war in Iraq, to the resurgence and rehabilitation of scientific racism. Just a fascinating figure. And I was very happy to review the book. And I was not alone. David Theon also wrote about the book. And David is, of course, editor at Jewish Currents. And
I'm only a contributing editor at this
contributing
point.
Editor. It's not all, a frequent yeah. writer, a frequent writer for both The Nation and The New Republic, and a frequent guest of this program. David, let's go into it. I think maybe you have some thoughts about the different approaches you and I took to writing about Marty Peretz.
Yeah, well, the simplest way to distinguish between, I mean, we had similar reactions to the book. We both, you know, think he's a terrible person, and we both loved the book, and we're not the only ones. I know other people with, you know, in the same political ballpark as us who loved it, and I've heard anecdotally that it it's very it's been passed around a lot with great excitement by people who at one point or another worked for TNR, regardless of their current politics and feelings about him. I mean, it's just kind of like, if you care about this world at all, it's a must read. And I don't think it, you know, it's any, you don't have to like soften your view of Peretz particularly to say that he's left us with a real gift here. Not that he's gone yet, but he is in his mid-80s. So
absolutely. In fact, in some ways, what makes the book interesting is that like he does not diminish any of the reasons for disliking him, and it makes them very evident and clear. But he
sure gives you a lot to chew on, and he's, you know, I wouldn't say he's a good writer exactly, but he's a compelling writer. He certainly has a voice. You can't deny he has a voice.
Yeah, I think the point of comparison is another book that both you and I also wrote about, which is Norman Parnas's Making It,
no book has reminded me so much in all the good and bad ways. And of course, Parnas wrote several other memoirs after Making It that are, you know, not as amazing, but kind of follow in the same vein. So yeah, I even wrote that in my piece that Making It is the obvious point of comparison here.
In both cases, sort of autobiographies of like very unlikable and destructive figures, but who are like sort of have the sort of guile of their own ideological, lack guile. and are actually let you know more about themselves than I think that they might necessarily want to you to know.
So personality-wise, they have that in common, and then their biographies being, you know, outer borough Jewish guys of roughly the same age, whose parents were, you know, Yiddish-speaking immigrants, who spoke Yiddish themselves growing up, and who kind of, you know, made it to the center of power, and hugely influential neocon or neoconish magazines were obviously stalwart Israel supporters. All of these things they have in common. There are some important differences. One is that Podhoretz grew up a lot more working class. He also grew up in a more religious milieu, whereas Peretz basically grew up petty bourgeois. His father was an owner of landlord, which is an interesting detail in this, and the owner of a small factory. So really, maybe even a little better than petty bourgeois. But also, Podhoretz is so wedded to Manhattan, and since making it, Peretz has actually been all over the place, but especially Cambridge, Massachusetts. So there's, and Peretz stayed dedicated to the Democratic Party, a version of it anyway, while Podhoretz has been a Republican since the, well, 70s, I guess.
I would ask one other further, I think, very crucial difference, which is tied to the Democratic Party aspect, which is that Podhoretz is like a notorious homophobe.
Yes.
You know, like I'd argue at one point that it would be wrong to find a cure for AIDS because this would only allow gay men to continue, in his words, buggering themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, for
homophobia is not just an incidental thing. It's sort of an abiding lifelong obsession for Podhoretz, to the point where I'm not here to suggest he's gay. I don't think he is. But I think that he I think he protests a little too much anyway. I think his masculinity is very vulnerable and threatened, which is something our mutual acquaintance Ronnie Greenberg has written about in Write Like a Man. Whereas Peretz is was in a sort of a glass closet for decades. And as of this book being published last year, is officially out. He calls himself gay in the book repeatedly.
That's right.
But there's still a lot to say about that. But I did, I mean, that should be a whole section of this conversation, frankly. But one thing I did want to say about our competing approaches, Jeet, is we both read this book, I think, right when it came out last summer, early fall. I banged out a review for The Baffler, which I'm very happy with, you know, within like a couple weeks of reading it. I just felt inspired and I went, and I think it's a solid review. You did a much more exciting review. We're recording this in late May. So your review is basically the product of like 8 or 9 months of, I mean, not to say you didn't have other things going on. I'm sure you did. But I feel like you you went down a number of rabbit holes. You really, for like, I mean, you for you, this is like, you're older than me, and this is like a lifelong obsession, basically. And this book just gave you so many different avenues you wanted to pursue, and it had to be, you know, reined in at some point to actually be published. The result is wonderful, but I'm struck by how, like, you... Like, you wanted to, like, fact-check every claim he made in the book, basically.
Yeah, no, at one point I was actually, like, doing that, and there are, like, a number of claims that he made that are not true, but, I mean, which ended up being immaterial to the review. But it is the case that I have been, I started to hate read Peretz's New Republic starting the early 80s. I continue to hate read it.
I was born in the mid-80s, so that really wasn't an option for me.
Into like the end of his kind of tenure, I think around like 2012 or 2013. And so I had a lot of baggage with that. And in working on the review, I did want to try to do a more definitive kind of judgment. And so I read out a lot of the literature around the New Republic as well. So there's actually, a lot of reading that went into the review to, sort of situate both Peretz and his magazine and his period. This is all growing out of, you know, my sense of like his kind of importance. Like, and there's been a little bit of pushback I got from some people on Twitter. Well, is he that important? And I have to say, you know, like to use the classic Oppenheimer line, he's both self-important, but he's actually also important.
Yes.
That he, you know, this is a very much...
You could argue he is not present tense very important. You could argue that his importance peaked in the Bush era, basically, and that it's been downhill ever since. As someone who wants to write a book about all of these people, who's working on that right now, I maintain that they are all, some of them are currently important, others, their legacy remains very important. And I would say that's true of him, too. I would say his legacy is actually omnipresent. I think it's pretty hard to deny he was a major figure in American life from the mid-60s through 2010 or so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting to kind of define that importance, because this is his first book. He's not a kind of major theorist or intellectual in the way that some of the people at the New Republic have been. He's
right, actually, that's the other distinction we should draw between him and Podhoretz, is Podhoretz was always first and foremost an intellectual himself, or a pseudo-intellectual or a wannabe intellectual. Peretz had that strain in him. But the real reason he's important, and I say this in the first graph of my review, is who he married and the money that gave him and what he was able to do with that money.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. But to define his importance, though, because it is as a sort of, like, not just as a, you know, the publisher of the New Republic and the money poured in there, but the kind of social network he created. He is, like, a great example of networking effect. Yeah. And of he is the sort of almost classic rich person who was keeps a salon. And within that salon, the great issues of the day are kind of argued out, and then they spread out through the world. Now, that salon, as you suggested, was not possible without the kind of money of his second wife. But throughout his career, his path of upward trajectory has not been intellectual achievement. It has been marriage. Yeah, as you indicated, you know, coming out of, you know, I would probably say like middle class kind of Jewish background, but at a period when he was born, you know, the 30s and 40s, where Jews were still marginal to the American elite, becoming part of the first generation of American Jews who were, like, you know, basically accepted as white within the world of Harvard and really integrated into the establishment. And in his case, integrated, like, in the most intimate way possible through marriage. His first marriage was to a wealthy Jewish heiress, you know, who had a citrus farm fortune, and introduced them into the world of celebrity. So, you know, he came from this, what he describes as a marginal background, but with his first wife, was suddenly starting to throw large parties where, like, celebrities like Shelley Winters were showing up. And then with his second wife, Anne Peretz,
Anne Labouisse, in fact.
Yes. She came from, like, a fabulously wealthy world. Her family traces its money back to the Singer sewing machine, but then also subsequently...
Notably to the WASP side of the Singer fortune. There's, like, the Jewish side, which is Singer, and then there's, like, the lawyer side, which was WASP's. And that's her side.
And Peretz, like, talks, like, quite frankly about this many times, about the amount of, like, you know, like, this is basically, if not quite Rockefeller money, like, in the same ballpark as Rockefeller money. I mean, the anecdote I use in my piece is, like, you know, when Anne was growing up, there was a painting that her grandfather owned that she loved, and she would come look at it, and she wrote a term paper about it. So her grandfather left her that painting as part of her bequest, and that was a Rembrandt. So the family owned, like, innumerable Picassos, Matisse's, so very wealthy family. And you gotta say, like, okay, so this guy, like, in this autobiography, he says, you know, he is a gay. That's how he identifies himself. He was twice married to quite wealthy women, one fabulously wealthy. He has notoriously been kind of open closet case. I don't think his sexuality was ever that much of a secret. Certainly, like, when I was reading The New Republic in the 80s and 90s, I will quote a politically incorrect comment by Gore Vidal. I guess who can get away with it because he was gay, but in the 80s, he referred to, in an interview with the Washington Post, he referred to Peretz as, quote, the Queen of Israel. And so I, to me, that would indicate that appearing in the Washington Post would indicate that, you know, like, Peretz.
I mean, to give a few other examples. So one, to mention the Podhoretzes again, one that's actually in the controversialist was, you know, Midge Dector, Norman Pudhartz's infamously homophobic wife,
yes,
wrote a piece in commentary, basically all but saying that Marty Peretz was gay back in like the 80s. And there's a wonderful line in The Controversialist where I'll just quote this. I have this passage in my review. This is Marty Peretz speaking. "It was not like I didn't know there were plenty of people in Washington who didn't like me and who might use the opportunity to hurt me by referencing my own private life. Midge Dector, Norman Pudhartz's wife, couldn't stand our stance on gay marriage." The New Republic, to its credit, was one of the first major magazines to endorse gay marriage in a piece by Andrew Sullivan, famously. And she hinted in one of her pieces in commentary that I was gay. The Pudhartzes were, in their mind, fighting for civilization, even as in practice they were arguing for a very narrow definition of it. Their insinuations worried me a little, until Anne pointed out that none of commentary's readers would understand a veiled homosexual reference anyway. Now, this is very funny to me, not just as a burn on commentary readers, but because it's one of a number of places in the book where he kind of implies, but doesn't quite say, that Anne was in on the joke, too.
Yeah.
And this is a very, very weird thing, because she did eventually divorce him, apparently because of his temper. I have heard other rumors, and I don't think I can legally say them on a podcast like this. Just going off what's in the book, it is very weird how he writes about his sexuality throughout the book, because basically he, in what's a candid memoir about his feelings on everything, his opinions on everyone he ever crossed, which are a lot of fun too, his political positioning, what he stands by, which is most of it, what he doesn't, which is basically the invasion of Iraq, and which is interesting in and of itself. But in all, and then of course he does identify as gay, and as a sort of a permanent state of being, he describes himself as gay, but for the first time. But there are some very obvious questions that raises that he does not get into. For instance, did you think of yourself as gay when you married your first wife? Did you think of yourself as gay when you married your second wife? Why don't you identify as bi? Clearly you've had sexual relations with a woman at some point. You have two children, who no one doubts the paternity of. Did Anne know you were gay? How much did Anne know that you were gay? How much did your first wife know that you were gay? And here's one. I believe that in addition to his first and second wife, at some point early in the book, he alludes to other women, or at least one other woman that he slept with. Does he name a single man in his entire life he slept with in the book? If he does, he doesn't identify them as such. You're left to speculate. Who are the men Marty Peretz has been sleeping with? And they're certainly possible names that come to mind, none of which I'm going to suggest. But, like, who are they? It's a weird blind spot. Like, that part of his life is still sacred. Or maybe they're all closeted, too. I don't know.
No, it's a weird blind spot. And I have to say, you know, like, one can treat this sort of like bearded marriage, like, with some sympathy, you know, as a historical artifact.
Yes.
Certainly, I mean, you know, the recent movie about Leonard Bernstein brought this out, that, you know, like, Leonard Bernstein was clearly gay, you know, with maybe some bisexual inclinations, but predominantly attracted to men. His wife, Felisa Montalegre, knew about this, you know, like, and so this is a very complicated type of marriage that used to exist in the sort of, you know, pre-Stonewall, gay liberation era.
Yeah, and I get the sense part of being like a hip cultured person was kind of winking and nodding and understanding what this was the whole time. And you get the sense that was what was going on a lot of the time around.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, there are different ways of doing it. And it didn't get into my review, but there's an interesting point of comparison to be made between Marty Peretz and, I'm almost horrified to say this, but the great science fiction writer Samuel R. Delaney. They both went to actually the same high school, Bronx Science, at around the same time in the 50s. They didn't quite overlap because Delaney's a little younger. Delaney, when he's a teenager, realized he was attracted to other boys and to men, married as a teenager his classmate Marilyn Hacker, who was aware of his sexual attraction, but was, you know, they wanted to get married so they could start their own life. She later came out as a lesbian, but they also both, and Delaney wrote about this all wonderfully with incredible precision and emotional tact in his fantastic autobiography, The Motion of Light on Water. And in that book, you know, like one gets a plausible emotional sense of what that type of relationship was like, and the way in which that they, even though their own sexual interests went in different directions, they did also occasionally have sex with each other, did occasionally share partners. So there's an interesting
contrast. Well, and also it's fascinating
to be drawn between Delaney and Peretz, where, you know, Delaney is as candid as one can be about one's, like, marriage and sexual life, and Peretz is, you know, not that way, even though he's candid about many other things.
Well, and including that he at least seems to maintain or want to have on paper that he maintains a lot of affection and respect for his ex-wife. And they've been divorced for, I think, at least a decade now.
Yeah.
You know, apparently he still wears his ring. I mean, It's like on some level he understands, A, that even though it was an open secret, that there's something a little humiliating about having been married to a gay man for as long as she was. B, you know, I think there's some consciousness, because he writes so lustfully, really, about her money and her family power and connections too, there's some sense too that, like, you know, he's aware that that you know, his whole life and everything he's done was facilitated by this woman's inherited fortune, and of course she's also the mother of their children, who he also writes very affectionately about. So
I did as you say this, but there's an argument you made that this is like one of the worst husbands in human history, because I mean, you look at it, okay, you know, there's that sort of, you know, very tangled issue, like, even if she had been aware of it, like, it is kind of there's a little bit of embarrassment, you know, about his sexuality coming out the way it does this late in life. But then also the fact that, you know, her father was, like, very active in the United Nations, supporting Palestinian rights. And, like, Peretz and he would, like, argue about it all the time. Then Peretz also, like, squandered her family fortune, which is an immense fortune. And, like, it's almost unimaginable that you could ruin a fortune of that size.
And squandered it on political projects that, in some cases, she disagreed with. I mean, when they got together, they were New Left. I mean, she was basically a rebellious enfant terrible who wanted to do good with our narrative privilege, which I can only respect. And he was this climber, and they were basically both in this New Left space. I mean, their early fundraising was for, you know, Eugene McCarthy campaign, and for like a lot of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, their activities. He has early, actually very insightful passages about them. I mean, everyone who gets mentioned in this book, he has something fascinating, good or bad, to say about. Or in King's case, good, but also nuanced, I thought, and thoughtful. He, you know, I would love to read her memoir. I doubt we'll ever see that, but I'd love to hear this, like, super rich WASP girl who, like, joins the New Left, is captured by the romance of this, as we know, gay Jewish guy from the Bronx, who's you know, the sort of man about town at Cambridge. They throw all these dinner parties. They meet everyone famous in the world. They you know, are almost like going to be guests in the Al Gore White House if that had happened, because Gore was one of his many proteges and I'm sure beneficiaries. And then in the end, it all falls apart. Plus, as he notes, she did not support the Iraq War, which is one of the last, arguably, it's the most consequential thing Peretz era TNR supported. It's certainly on the short list. So that's part of where her family fortune went, was propagandizing that.
Yeah, no, we don't have to get a lot of sense of, like, her politics. And I mean, she's a bit of a sort of wrath-like figure in this book. And the few times that she sort of speaks out, it's interesting because she's actually, like, giving him, like, you know, well, good advice, or, you know, saying, like, well, you know, Leon Wiesel's here, you know, you got to rein him in the way he's treating women at the in the office. Also, I mean, he says, like, well, she's a peacenik from way back, which is, like, almost, he's derisively speaking.
Oh, that's how he dismisses her opposition to the Iraq War. Yeah. She's always a peacenik, you know?
So this all suggests something very... yeah, no, I mean, there is a kind of story there that one can sort of infer, which is, like, not very flattering to him. But it, again, only sort of hints at. But, I mean, so, you know, like, with this marriage, you know, they started, as you say, on the New Left. And we're also, like, I think one of the major things was this New Politics Conference in 67 that was trying to bring together the anti-war movement and the Black freedom struggle, with the idea of like nominating Martin Luther King Jr. and Dr. Spock as presidential candidates, and that all fell apart. And I think that's actually a crucial moment. This trauma that occurred at the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago, because he basically says, you know, like, well, he was not respected. He was treated as, you know, Mr. Moneybags,
right,
and not given the kind of deference he was due. And I think this actually speaks to the sort of real class politics that underlies his shift from the left to the right, which is to say, he wanted gratitude. He wanted to be seen as, you know, someone who's being beneficent, this sort of paterfamilias of the left. And he was not treated that way. And this is a period where there's immense tension between Black and white, between the sort of establishment and the insurgent anti-war movement, the young and the old. He kind of like, you know, that disrespect, I think, is the real trauma that is the fulcrum of his politics, the fulcrum of that shift. And that's very interesting.
No, it's a very astute point. And, you know, you open your review with an anecdote from the book that is sort of a skeleton key for you about his relationship to Susan Sontag. You should summarize that. But I think it gets at this exact point you're making.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, for us to give him credit, like he and used his wife's money for many good deeds, one of which was like Susan Sontag, when she had cancer, had no health care. You know, she was a freelancer, and her friends rallied behind her and, you know, raised money. He didn't know her. They donated quite a bit of money, and, you know, they had dinner with her, and she was, you know, apparently rude to him and to Anne, like, you know, saying, oh, like, she's a nice house, a housewife and whatnot. And so for Fritz, like, you know, this is very galling that, you know, like this stranger that, you know, he had given money for, and he's frank. He gave her money because he hoped to be introduced into the inner circle of intellectual life, you know, like was disrespectful. Now, one has to say, like, there's that anecdote has many emotional layers. Like, from Susan Sontag's point of view, like, you know, like, it's not good to be taking money from being so reliant on rich friends. And it is a bit embarrassing for someone as proud as she was to be, you know, put in the position of Oliver Twist and say, like, you know, please, Mr. and Mrs. Peretz, can I have some more? And, you know, doff her cap to them. But on his side, it's like, well, the ingratitude. But also, like, this weird idea that you can be part of Susan Sontag's inner circle by giving her money, whereas, like, you know, like that sort of intellectual cachet only really comes from achievement.
Right. I mean, what makes Peretz such a fascinating character, I think, and I have encountered such people in the wild occasionally, is the reason why he matters. As soon as he marries Anne, as soon as they start throwing all this money around, the most important thing about him will always be money. And the reason people want to get to know him is money. But although Peretz is, as we say, not one of the great intellectuals of all time, he's not an idiot either, at least not a, he's, nor is he like boring. He is clearly some sort of an intellectual. He was a promising student. He was a promising young Yiddishist. He studied under, you know, Herbert Marcuse at Brandeis. And he was, you know, he was a lecturer at Harvard. I think that he was already doing that when he met Anne. So like he was on the make as an intellectual, but then he becomes first and foremost a money guy. And that's how everyone relates to him. And his intellectual chops are not so insignificant that he doesn't continue writing and interacting with people and wanting to be treated as an intellectual peer, but nor is he so impressive that, or, you know, plus he's just kind of a blowhard in a lot of ways, nor is he so impressive that everyone really values him for that. So it creates this kind of constant insecurity and tension that I think this Sontag thing gets at, because some money people understand that their primary role is to be money people. Mm-hmm. And some money people have intellectual pretensions, but they're so laughable that they, you know, that everyone just kind of like tiptoes around them. But in Peretz's case, it's like he dubbed himself the editor-in-chief of New Republic, even though what he really was the publisher. And there was always at any given time another front of the book editor, but that person served at his pleasure and could be, you know, spun out at any time. And he sat in on quite a lot of editorial meetings, and his editorial vision absolutely shaped the place. It wasn't just a guy, you know, giving an editor money to do whatever they wanted. Which makes him a particular kind of figure. Apropos of this, I also want to quote, you've probably read this before, but Jim Lehrer of PBS, I'm quoting this straight off Wikipedia, but whatever. In 1993, wrote a novel called Blue Hearts, which I'd like to read, which was set in DC. It was a roman à clef. And he introduces a character named Jonathan Perry, who is widely assumed to be Marty Peretz. And this is a quote from Lehrer's novel describing Jonathan Perry. He was a lightweight sociology professor of no special talent or accomplishment who owned and edited the magazine The New World because his wife was a shoe company heiress who bought it for him. He was a joke in all circles except those that believed money was important. He had made himself even more foolish by writing a recent column accusing the producers of public television and radio of blacklisting him for his strong pro-Israel views. It was an embarrassing incoherence that only the owner of a publication could have brought to public print. So, I mean, not very subtle who he's referring to there.
Yeah,
but captures something about how DC journalists of that era might have talked about Marty behind his back.
Yeah, no, I'd to sort of just underscore this point, I think there's another fascinating story that I alluded to with this British journalist, Henry Fairley, who had been a staff writer at the New Republic. And he's a kind of, you know, fascinating character, was a very big figure in sort of British journalism, Fleet Street, insulted Lady Antonia Fraser by referring to her as a very vulgar word for prostitute on television, which led to a lawsuit, and he had to flee England, came to the United States, was taken up by the New Republic, but was always a kind of, you know, down on his luck kind of figure, often sometimes unhoused, and so he had to sleep on the couch of the magazine. But he, you know, was having heart problems in the early 80s, and then Peretz paid for his heart surgery. Fairley talks about, like, the, you know, both his gratitude, but analyzing Peretz from through this prism of someone who needs to be loved and was using money to be loved. Fairley's analysis was that Peretz had his fingers burned. This is what he said to Esquire in the 80s. He said the worst people to raise money for were the left. And Fairley added, it's an incredible thing about the rich. They do need to be loved. So this is, I think that's a pretty interesting source. And it does get to some of the heart of the emotional ties of his kind, the emotional trauma of his both romance with the left, getting his fingers burned, realizing he's not loved by black radicals. Well, like, as if Black Panthers in 1967 didn't have many other things to worry about than, like, you know, should they love Marty Peretz? But in any case,
I mean, a lot of that is Israel also. We should.
And Israel. Actually, in some ways, very prescient. Like, if you actually look at the New Left, they were not that anti-Israel. But he did kind of have a sense that the emerging Black Power movement would take a decolonized turn. In some ways, something that really, you know, has taken up steam, like, in recent years. But, you know, he was very astute in realizing that, and therefore, you know, shifting his political allegiance further and further to the right, but stay, unlike the neoconservatives, staying within the Democratic Party. And
right, I which was the neoconservative project until about 1980.
That's right.
And really, he's the one who kept. He's never identified as a neoconservative. And in fact, in the book, he explicitly at one point contrasts himself with them. And one of the main contrasts he draws is that is their dynasticism that Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz and other neocons prepared, you know, their sons to be successors. Whereas Marty Peretz's kids are, you know, young creatives who I'm sure have had helping hands at various points, but he's sort of kept them out of politics. Mm. And interestingly, Jesse Peretz, the son who's a director and a co-founder of the band The Lemonheads, is quite talented and also has been out front with left-wing views on the current Israel-Gaza conflict. I mean, he's been out front calling for a ceasefire. He's one of a handful of Hollywood Jews who has been, and, which is also interesting to psychoanalyze vis-a-vis his father.
Yeah, no, I don't know. He has an interesting kind of space of sharing many of the same views as the neocons, especially on foreign policy, especially on Israel, but not just Israel, the anti-communism, the retrenchment of the welfare state. But the obsession with race. Yeah, exactly. The affirmative action as a kind of prism for viewing race relations.
I mean, honestly, the major distinction between him and them is that he stayed a Democrat after 1980.
Well, he stayed a Democrat, but also, you know, like on social issues, you know, he has always supported reproductive freedom. And
yes.
Gay, even though he was closeted, he supported gay rights.
Right. Now, the neocons, I mean, I feel like many of them today have kind of landed, now that it's safe to, on the liberal side of those two issues. But yeah, you can't say that they were advocates for them in the 80s. The 90s.
No, particularly that first generation of Irving Kristol, Norman Potteritz, Gertrude Hegel Farb. They were all like moral traditionalists. And
yes.
You mentioned Ronnie Greenberg's book. I think that's actually a key contribution of the book. Like just how much sort of homophobia and heteronormative views were a pillar of their politics, not just...
Absolutely.
And on that issue, like he is... I mean, it's a very curious thing because he's both pro-gay, but closeted, and in some ways cut off from the gay community. I noticed this when he said, well, you know, like Andrew Sullivan was the first openly gay editor of a major magazine. Now, what one could say, well, it depends on what you define as major, but I have to say, you know, the Nation had an openly gay, very openly gay militant editor, Andrew Kopkin, well before Andrew Sullivan. The Vanity Fair had an openly gay editor. Art Forum had an openly lesbian editor. And if Peretz had been actually part of the homosexual milieu, he would have known this, right? He would have known, like, you know, who the prominent gay figures are. But he was, like, so closeted and so cut off politically.
Some of that may also be that he usually wasn't in New York, although he sometimes was. And in fact, so the New York childhood in the Bronx we've talked about a little, but with what's really interesting in the book, and you got into a little more than me, is his Wall Street ties.
No, absolutely. And I actually think the way to think about this is as a social network. And I'm glad you had mentioned, you know, like he spent a lot of his time in Cambridge. So, you know, he was a lecturer at Harvard. And again, I think the money played a part. Like he was like, you know, basically kind of what we would call an adjunct, you know, like, you know, not non-tenured faculty, but he was hobnobbing always with the president of Harvard, like Larry Summers, you know, which is not something that's...
No, he also has an endowed Yiddish chair in his name. He's also, it should be said, he's the, I think it was his like father's cousin or something like that, was I.L. Peretz, who was one of the great Yiddish writers. And there's a I.L. Peretz square in Lower Manhattan next to Katz's Delicatessen, which Marty spoke in Yiddish at the dedication of when he was a kid. But so he comes from this Yiddish line, and he has a dedicated like Yiddish endowment at Harvard, and the chair of it, at least for a long time, maybe still, was Ruth Weiss, the, you know, I think it's fair to call her neoconservative champion of Jewish power. So that's one of many branches of his legacy, but
Harvard really, he understood, and he described himself as a Harvard patriot, but he really understood how power worked at Harvard, which is that this is a place of elite reproduction. You get all these young students who are going to have great future careers. You can mold them and make connections with them, which he did. He often recruited them, as in the case, I think, of Michael Kinsley and Andrew Sullivan, into the New Republic, but also future politicians like Al Gore, future civil servants like Anthony Blinken, Merrick Garland.
Major best-selling writers like Michael Lewis, who like shaped the culture well beyond little intellectual circles.
That's right. And been a New Republic writer. So at Harvard, he's able to, like, you know, be that sort of teacher who makes the social network that has tendrils both in journalism and in politics. But as you say, and this is actually, I think, something, I mean, the Ivy Leagues have always had, you know, a Wall Street connection. But what was new was these sort of Wall Street upstarts who, you know, were coming out of places like Harvard and went in and be as proteges of Barney Brands, went to Wall Street, and then, you know, in the 80s, in this era of deregulation, you know, really pioneered the financialization of the economy, the triumph of junk bonds and private equity. And so as we're thinking about, you know, you can roll off the names, but these are major figures.
Yeah, and I did not, I wouldn't say it shocked me, but it did not occur to me before I read this book how many personal ties he had to that world. I knew he had the inherited fortune from Anne. I knew he obviously was Harvard. I knew the DC connections, the journal. That was all obvious, although wonderful to read about. But yeah, the personal ties he had to usually very controversial figures who had sort of broken into Wall Street in the 80s speak to both. I mean, one reason why this book is a must read, I think, is because it does show these sort of complex networks over a generation between the Ivies, political power in DC, elite media, and also Wall Street, and this figure who sort of acts all of them. It's a fascinating look at how American power works or did work for a while.
Yeah, and I want to just bring off some of the names because I think it's very interesting. Like Ivan Boisky, Michael Milken, Michael Steinhardt. Now, I have to say, all these figures have had run-ins with the law. You know, like
Steinhardt is also one of the most important Jewish philanthropists in America. You can't understand Jewish institutional life today without reference to him. So, of course, Peretz knew him.
Yeah,
Peretz also. And actually, in the last days of Peretz's DNR, when he no longer had his wife's money to go on, the people who were keeping the magazine afloat until he sold it to Chris Hughes, and it entered, a period of never-ending tumult that we're still in. But for that, the main backers of it for a few years were Michael Steinhardt and Roger Herzog, who's one of the main funders of neoconservatism generally.
Yeah. And then both of whom, like, I think voted Republican, but were funding this allegedly liberal magazine. And so these are figures who, like, both, you know, like, powered the sort of, you know, the greed is good era of Wall Street, in the Oliver Stone classic movie, you know, like, really, in many cases, went to the outer limits of the law. I'll mention Michael Steinhardt is now no longer legally allowed to trade in antiquities because he had been, like, you know, trading in stolen goods from a place like Iraq. But also, like, you know, Jim Cramer, Lloyd Blackfein, Bill Ackman.
Bill Ackman is mentioned a few times in the book, though none of the mentions are that interesting, considering how colorful he's turned out to be. But yes, of course, he's also a Marty Peretz guy. And then you realize, like, the crisis that's shaping, like, every elite campus in America as we speak is not just thematically aligned with a lot of Marty Peretz's fixations. It's very directly tied to his network.
Yeah, no, it's this network of very wealthy Wall Street guys who, you know, have some Ivy League connection, are big donors, and in the current crisis, you know, in the involving Israel and Gaza, are basically like destroying American higher education, are pushing these elite universities.
In the name of saving it, I should say.
Sense of saving it, but actually like destroying long-held traditions of free speech, traditions of like de-escalation protest.
So I'm a Columbia alum and have been paying extra close attention to what goes on at Columbia, not only because of my personal connection to it, but because it plays such a large role in the 1968 uprisings, and I think it probably was the most notable of these protests now, and spurred a lot of other ones. And I was actually up in the neighborhood the other day in Morningside Heights, and the campus, which, you know, is the centerpiece of that neighborhood and has multiple public day and night ways you can walk through it, everything is fenced off right now because of these protests. And the joke, but it's not really a joke, that you'll hear from, you know, faculty and grad students right now is that Manoush Shafiq, the pretty new president of Columbia, who is responsible for the recent, you know, escalation, the police crackdown, more than one police crackdown, all of it. The line is that she has finally succeeded in creating the ideal neoliberal university, one that has no faculty and no students on campus at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, there is a direct connection between the sort of social network of plutocratic donors that Marty Peretz cultivated and what's going on now. And when actually, there's a great Washington Post report about this sort of like what's the app group among very wealthy donors, all of whom had been urging Eric Adams to like, unleash the police on the protesters. So, and that, I mean, that group of people.
Not something Eric Adams is particularly reluctant to do, I should say.
No, he isn't. But still, like, it's, that direct intervention of the donor class into like policing of universities is very striking. And that group is like, pretty heavy. There's an overlap between that group and, let's say, the index of Marty Peretz's The Controversialist. So this is very much a kind of story. And it's a weird kind of thing that Peretz, even though in a lot of ways, what makes the book interesting to me is he kind of admits that, his political project has ended like in great bitterness and failure. He's like, there's a lot of self-doubt in this book.
Yeah, can we actually read the incredible passage that I think we both quoted? Let me find it. I think every review I've read of this book quotes this paragraph, which is from the introduction of the book. Right away reading this, you're in for an interesting ride. He says, I'm quoting out of your review here. The invasion of Iraq, which I backed, is a disaster. The financial system that my friends helped build has crashed. My wife and I are divorced. The New Republic is sold after I feared going bust. And here I am in my white suit walking around Harvard Yard, surrounded by students. Harvard, Harvard, shame on you, honoring a racist fool. The racist fool is apparently me. It's a sodden coda, one I don't quite grasp or believe. Frankly, first of all, I want to say, I think this is, especially that last line, a wonderful literary passage, just right there. I mean, you can't say this guy doesn't have a theory of his life and its significance. The incident that he's referring to, the racist fool, what year was that? 2011, 2012?
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
Yeah, Harvard was setting up this chair in his name.
Yeah, $700,000 they raised for it.
A blog, as he was wont to do often, like very racist things in the New Republic. In this case, saying that, questioning whether Muslims should have First Amendment rights.
I think for many media people my age or younger, if Marty Peretz's name means anything to them at all, it's, that guy who used to write racist things on this blog, The Spine, at the New Republic, usually about Arabs, sometimes about Black people. And that was kind of my introduction to him, too. And then I started learning a lot more because it was always sort of like, because I knew people who were involved in the New Republic at that time when The Spine still existed, circa 2009-10. You'd sort of ask them, like, how do you live with this just like blatant racist on your masthead? And the answer is basically it's a good job and he pays the bills. But it was just sort of incredible to me. Like everyone there, I think, was embarrassed by it. Even people who are, politically not that far left understood that this was really not cool. But it was a lot easier to denounce it after he was disgraced and, as we say, canceled.
Exactly. But not just disgraced and canceled, but like no longer writing the text. I actually think that is the crucial point. And to go back to that scene in Harvard, which is a great scene. Which
you can see on YouTube, by the way. Find that. Yeah.
Which actually someone should take that YouTube scene and also that passage and add in, the Curb Your Enthusiasm music at the end, and you would have the perfect video. The crucial thing for me is this guy had actually been a racist fool for decades, right? And I quote in my review many of the things that he said about the Arabs and Blacks, but I mean, it is quite basically saying like at, 1982, that the goal, what Israel should do is to inflict a lasting military defeat on the Palestinians in the West Bank, so that the struggle for an independent state has suffered a setback of many years, and then the Palestinians will be turned into just another crushed nation, like the Kurds or Afghans, which is like a really remarkable, like kind of openly imperialist view, like, to crush people, and particularly ignorant, like in retrospect, because, the thing with the Afghans, the Kurds, or the Palestinians is that, they actually have never been crushed. They continue fighting. But so he said all these racist things and also many hair-raising things about African Americans as culturally deficient. He was always accepted into polite society and always accepted into as a journalist figure. People continue to work for him. and to, you know, they wouldn't openly defend him, but, you know, like they wouldn't criticize him until he'd lost his money and until he had to sell the New Republic. And then it became open season on Marty Perret. And people, like, you know, like no longer defend him the way they once did. And so,
and
I have to
say, two profiles were written of him at the time, in like a year after this, one in New York Magazine, one in the New York Times Magazine, both of which dance, like, in very, very obviously dance around his sexuality, because as I understand it, at the time, he was living in Tel Aviv with a, like, much younger IDF soldier, and he was, like, having magazine journalists come and cover him, and they could meet this guy, and they could see that he lived with this guy, and they could easily tell what was going on, but they weren't allowed to say it because of, you know, convention and agreement. Ucker at the time actually did a post that was like, because, you know, this is what Gawker existed to do, basically, that was like, why won't people just say Marty Perret is gay already? It's like the not at all buried subtext of these pieces. And you can sort of see the authors of those pieces like straining, desperately wanting to tell the reader, like, the man is gay. That's what's going on here. He's gay, but they can't do it.
No, they couldn't do it. And then so I mean, I think the money again is a crucial kind of thing. That, I mean, Gawker deserves credit here, but, you know, like a lot of things that were true about Perret were true for many years, were unsayable as long as he had that money, as long as he was a potential employer. And there's an entire generation of liberal journalists, like the most prominent liberal journalists, that went along with this. And I have to say, it's a very damning fact of liberalism that this happened. And this might, you know, again, we've been talking about all his social network, the many people he knew. This might be a good place to, you know, like, mention the fact that, you know, this book has the most incredible index this side of Jeffrey Epstein's flight log. Like, of the people
everyone
who...
And anytime you look them up, there's something good. And actually, to summarize something of the experience of reading the book, I want to quote the journalist Matthew Zeitlin, who read the book and then tweeted what he tongue-in-cheek called his review of it. His review was just screenshots from the iPhone Notes app. And he had done two columns of it, which he marked people Marty Perret's likes and people Marty Perret's dislikes. And I think these two columns summarize the book about as well as anything. So in the people Marty Perret's likes column are Herbert Marcuse, Michael Walzer, Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, Max Lerner, Henry Kissinger, Hendrik Hertzberg, Michael Kinsley, Charles Krauthammer, Leon Wieseltier, Jamie Gorelick, Al Gore, Stephen Breyer, Nita Lowey, Leon Botstein, and Larry Summers. And in the people Marty Perret's dislikes column are James Foreman, the Kennedy family, Richard Goodwin, his father-in-law, the director of UNRWA, Lillian Hellman, Susan Sontag, Carl Oglesby, Michael Kazin, Alexandra Coburn, Sidney Blumenthal, Ira Magaziner, Al Sharpton, Hillary Clinton, Midge Dechter, Homi Bhabha, Robert Scheer, and Peter Beinart. And to that, I would add John Kerry. And of all of these people and many more, he just has his sort of candid opinions, which often come down to whether they treated him with what he judged to be respect or not.
That does seem to be like the kind of crucial divide, you know, like as to whether someone is good or bad. And, you know, like it does make, you know, on the one hand, the autobiography very narcissistic, but also, you know, like full of, as the kids say, a lot of spilled tea.
Yes.
There's a lot of, you know.
There's Hillary Clinton disinviting him from a White House dinner because of what he did to Hillary Kerr, which honestly, I've probably never respected her more than when I read that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also, apropos of the racism, there's an artifact I want to share with you here that I think my wife found in a little library around us, and it's on my shelf now. This little book that came out called The Bell Curve Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this?
Yes, I actually own a copy of that book.
You own a copy of the book.
Yeah, which shows how hardcore I am.
How sick both of us are. Yeah, so this is a book. This came out after Marty Perret's and Andrew Sullivan published Charles Murray's book of scientific racism, The Bell Curve, which much of the New Republic staff, even at the time, objected to. And so they ended up doing like a whole issue of rebuttals, and then they packaged that in this book. But yeah, I mean, you know, or the story that Ta-Nehisi Coates has kept alive is the racism angle to the Stephen Glass fiasco, which happened on Parrot's Watch. Which was, you know, everyone knows Stephen Glass was a fabulist and hopefully has seen the wonderful movie Shattered Glass about it. But that movie, though, I think it's accurate in the general shape of what he did and what it is like to work at the New Republic, and also presents Marty Peretz very badly in the one scene he's in. That movie completely ignored the substantive politics of the New Republic, and particularly on race. Stephen Glass wrote a totally made up article about how, you know, about the divisions between African immigrant, usually Ethiopian DC, and native born African American DC, in which he describes an incident, which is a rich topic, by the way, and the one you would want a serious journalist, ideally a Black journalist, to cover. But in fact, they had Stephen Glass covering it, and he just made up an incident in which he's in a cab being driven by an Ethiopian immigrant, and as he's interviewing him, they are hijacked and mugged by an African-American guy with a gun. And Marty Peretz ate that shit up. Marty Peretz loved that.
Well, no, did he eat it up? I mean, the sort of backstory of this is, I've heard this from like people who were at the New Republic at the time, but you know, at editorial meetings, Peretz would like say, like, you know, has anyone noticed like how many Africans, like Black people from Africa are cab drivers, and why aren't like, you know, Native American Blacks driving these cabs, you know, like what's going on here? And like basically, you know, like setting the whole premises of that article up, and basically like kind of like, you know, wanting someone to pick it up. And of course, Stephen Glass, you know, the fabulist, was like totally willing to feed into this racist fantasy of his boss. So yeah, I mean, he basically conjured into being a racist article. But I mean that's hardly the that only scratches the surface with the bell curve and this article. Like the real racism of the New Republic in the 80s and 90s, it's kind of like an obsession. In some ways, I mean, what we would consider the sort of Fox News Breitbart view of the world, like it was incubated by these Cold War liberals in the 70s and 80s, of a kind of obsession with affirmative action, with so-called Black crime, with the idea of Black-on-Black violence, with a view of Black culture as pathological.
Yeah. TNR's basic function was, I think, to make it respectable for liberals to say these things.
Exactly.
And to pave the way for, like, Clinton's welfare reform and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So I mean, that is also part of the legacy. Yeah, having said all that, I mean, it is as I said, like, you know, he's if not quite a pariah, you know, he went into steep kind of marginalization, you know, after he lost his wife's money and divorced. And so the story is in some ways it's a rise and fall story. It's a classic Victorian novel, you know, like the young man from the provinces, like the hero of The Red and the Black, you know, who rises to great heights and then falls. But having said that, I mean, the weird thing is, like, it's not quite no one will now defend Marty Peretz. And I noticed this with both your review and in my review that, you know, I felt my review got a lot of great traction. A lot of people I really respect praised it. It's been doing well for the nation. But I was expecting it to ignite, like, you know, at least some backlash from the pro-Peretz people.
And there aside are no pro-Peretz people.
Aside from a few dingbats on Twitter, you know, there are no pro-Peretz people.
I mean, there are people like Vladislav Davidzon, you know, right-wing trolls contrarians. I mean, the blurbs on the back of my copy come from Yo-Yo Ma, who we gather has been a friend of Peretz for a while, Michael Walzer, Jamie Gorelick, and Bernard-Henri Levy. So that's... That's who stands by him. Also, yeah, it was published by Wicked Sun, which is Adam Bellow's imprint.
He has no real defenders anymore. But having said that, I actually think his view of the world, what one can call a kind of reactionary centrism, like remains like immensely powerful. And one sees it in places like, well, on the more right-wing view in a place like the tablet, but the more sort of centrist presenting in the Atlantic, often in the New York Times op-ed section.
I mean, Jonathan Chait at New York Magazine, obvious heir. I would say much of the Atlantic today. I mean, I think Jeffrey Goldberg at least wrote for him, the editor-in-chief, but so did people like who else is there? Franklin Foer, obviously. Mm-hmm. Ann Applebaum used to write for Leon Wieseltier, who, and then Liberties. And Peretz, at the end of The Controversialist, actually lists some of his favorite publications today, which are basically Tablet, Barry Weiss's The Free Press, Liberties. And I forget if he mentions The Atlantic or not, but I would think The Atlantic is the most obvious heir to the role that New Republic played through the 90s and early aughts.
It is a very curious kind of thing of a politics that is, you know, presents itself as centrist or liberal, that is very critical of the Republican Party, but also sees a lot of its job as policing the left. And
It's anti-Trump and it's also anti-AOC.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In some ways, like, this politics, both, it is a particular cohort of, one can imagine a demographic of, wealthy people who aren't, like, Koch brother-type reactionaries might be attracted to this. But it's also it's something deeply rooted in the history of liberalism. And I think that one has to understand that liberalism has always been a politics that can swing both ways, that it is not necessarily aligned with the left, although it often is. And the real origins of liberalism, going back to the 18th century, is kind of like aristocratic privilege. It is the politics of the Whig or the French aristocrats who are unhappy with the decadence of absolutist rule. People who will align themselves with the left when it's necessary to challenge the old order, but in periods where the left becomes too ascendant, rapidly become reactionary, as Edmund Burke did. A former Whig did during the French Revolution. And so it's this politics of liberalism, of a kind of like elite reforming sensibility that situationally moves from the left to the right, depending on, its particular interests, is something that has very deep roots in history. And I think Peretz is an emblem of that. So it's not just him in particular.
Yeah, well, so I want to actually talk a little. This is something that I think if there's one thing my review did that I don't think anyone else's review really honed in on, it's Marty Peretz's theory of the sort of socioeconomics and of liberalism and how they have shifted over time, which is actually a running theme throughout the book.
Yeah.
And is maybe one of the fullest ideas that Marty himself articulates. It's not by any means an idea that's beyond critique, but it's an idea, and it is a running theme.
It's very, say that he's a very interesting sociologist, and I think he's the kind of practical sociologist you have to be if you're a climber. Like you have to kind of understand how power works and how ideas work in society, which he has. And
let me spell out what it is. I'm gonna quote him as I quoted him in my piece describing Peter Beinart, who was the editor of the New Republic from 99 through I forget the exact year, but at least through the launch of the Iraq War. Peter Beinart, I should say, with various disclosures here, I worked with him at Jewish Currents. I like him personally. He has had a very visible, publicly documented move leftward since the days when he supported the Iraq War and was very pro-Israel I think he might blanch a little at saying he's outright renounced Zionism as much as found a version of Zionism that is radically different from what most people think Zionism is. But in any case, he's very clearly moved far left on that issue, and in the process pissed off a lot of people who used to be his fellow travelers. Both Wieseltier and Peretz have denounced him by name in the last year or so. I think at least partly ideologically and partly because of what he wrote about Wieseltier's interpersonal contact with women at TNR, which is a whole other story and which Peretz clearly was aware of and alludes to as well in his book. But anyway, Beinart, at least in hindsight, Peretz and Wieseltier hate Beinart. And so Peretz writes this about Beinart in his book. He says, "In a sense, he was perfect, maybe even too perfect. On some inarticulable level, it felt too set up. Remember, I hadn't come from Cambridge, and neither had Rick, by which he means Hendrik Hertzberg, Mike Kinsley, or Leon Wieseltier. We were all smart people, but we didn't come perfectly minted. Peter, on the other hand, never had to break in. He'd come from the new American post-war institutional elite, and that was his definition of the world. And the rest of us, all the rest of us had different environments to draw from. And then I note that he also says similar things about Ben Rhodes, about the Obama administration, people generally, about Chris Hughes and Mark Zuckerberg, and then also about some members of his generation who he thinks are ashamed of their Jewishness, John Kerry, Madeleine Albright, George Soros, who are all at least partly Jewish. Sometimes they discovered that. The way I would describe the Peretz theory of the world that goes through the book is there was this generation of working to middle class Jews who were rooted in immigrant neighborhoods, in Yiddish milieus, with some connection often to traditional Orthodox Judaism, and above all, who were ethnics and outsiders looking in, and who you know, were usually born before World War II. And they come of age in the post-war era and in the 60s, where there are all these opportunities for them to get ahead at magazines and academia, Wall Street, in Washington. And they bring this outsider sensibility, which almost invariably, occasionally it's like an Irish Catholic or somebody, but the overwhelming majority of the time, what he means is Jewish kids born before the war who made good after the war. And that no matter how rich, powerful, influential, insider, basically insider defining they got, I mean, this is a guy who was going to mint a president in 2000, they retained the sort of view from the streets. And you can imagine Podhoretz saying very similar things.
Yeah, very strong parallel.
And so by contrast, the people that they have disdain for are on the one hand, people of roughly their generation, or maybe a little younger, who, even if they were Jewish, were faintly embarrassed to be Jewish and really wanted to be seen as WASPs, people like John Kerry, say, who was actually Catholic but had some Jewish background, but in any case kind of carries himself with a WASPy auteur in the world. They have disdain for that. And then on the other hand, people like Peter Beinart, who's, you know, I don't know, 50s or so, and, you know, grew up in Cambridge and has sort of like been on that like meritocratic elite track his whole life, you know, who are essentially the products of the assimilation that people like Peretz, you know, got, you know, they never made it quite to the promised land. And they did in a money and power sense, but not in a, like how they talked and who they were sense is how he sees it. Whereas a guy like Peter, even though he's every bit as, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish as Peretz and every bit as Harvard and TNR as Peretz, there's this sense that like something was lost, that they never had to be scrappy. They never had to be outer borough in the same way. And, you know, I find this both, you know, it's both a hyper-specific way to understand what's happened to the world in the last few decades, but it's not totally off base. There's something to it.
Yeah.
And mostly it's that, yeah, like of immigrant communities assimilate and change over time in measurable ways. I mean, Marty wasn't like his parents either.
Well, no, of course. I mean, in some ways, it's something you had mentioned in your review of Making It. You know, like, it's a weird paradox of the self-made man that, like, all the glory is being self-made, but then you have, you know, children who are, like, no longer can be self-made. So I mean, Peretz got everything he wanted. Like, you know, he was able to achieve great success, had a powerful magazine, did push the Democratic Party to the right, and Jews did become fully assimilated. But there's an ash in his mouth that, like, getting everything he wanted has not made him, like, happiness. In fact, produced these very polished people who are the opposite of what he wanted.
I mean,
there's both a sociology there and a sensibility. But also, I have to say, and I'm saying this, you know, someone who's not Jewish, but, like, a real sense of, like, only I know what is really Jewish.
Yeah.
And there's a particular way of being Jewish, which is me, and like all these other ways of being Jewish, like there's something fraudulent about them.
Which is a quality he shares very closely with Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, which of course I've written about.
And throughout the book, he's very contemptuous of basically the Jewish left. You know, like people like Chomsky say, you know, who have a way of being Jewish that he finds unacceptable. So I gotta say, like, you know, like, yes, there is a kind of, and there's a kind of sociology there where he says, you know, our goal was to humanize the technocracy, to realize, you know, like, you're going to get this elitist system based on these universities, but we will, you know, like, imbue on our students a humanist vision that will make them, give them a better politics and a better, deeper worldview. And he's basically, I mean, the thing is, if your goal was to humanize the technocracy and you produce, like, you know, Anthony Blinken and Lloyd Blankfein and, like, you know, like Jim Cramer, like, what the hell have you done? Like,
but,
you have
but, not but humanized. Kramer and Blinken are a little different because Kramer is still this kind of nebbishy character, cartoon character, whereas Blinken is like, I think is almost like the, he's like a factory made, you know, robotic super diplomat who is of Jewish background, but like has none of that kind of personality that a Marty Garrett or a Norman Van Ortz has. Like,
no, actually, yeah. But I mean, you have actually not. I mean, the people that you've produced, you know, like, you're humanizing the technocracy, and you know, you produce on the one hand these like very polished robotic political types who gravitate towards the center, or these Wall Street goons who are like pillaging the economy. Like you have actually not, you've actually produced a ruling class that is amazingly like even less humane and less cultured than like the, you know, the Philistines that came before you. Like it's
or,
just,
or the wasps that came before you. He's talking about clearing out the old wasp establishment to make room for upstart Jews.
Yeah, I mean, people like George Kennan, you know, there's a lot of terrible things about them, but they actually had a level of culture and of like real achievement that, you know, like has totally been lost. And you have a ruling class that's like much less intelligent, much less worldly, much less cosmopolitan, much less able to even maintain the empire, you know, than what came before. So I have to say, your entire friggin' project was a failure. It's a great thing that the book does make that clear. Like, I think this is an achievement of the book.
No,
that you really see what a failure this has all been.
What makes it great literature is that Peretz, who was just a great character, I mean, he would be an amazing fictional character, is aware of the failure and has some theory of the failure, but can't quite, no matter how hard he tries, he can't quite grasp at the full scope of the failure because it would be such an indictment of himself and his judgment.
As you see in that great passage, you say, you know, is this the sodden world that has created? Now, I we've gone like really long, and I don't think we have. I mean, I think we had wanted to talk about Leon Wieseltier.
Yeah, that's got to be another.
That's got to be another one. Discussion. But I promise you, we will get to a full discussion of Leon Wieseltier because, like, in some ways, I mean, Wieseltier's authenticity is not just, you know, like working class Jewish, but also, you know, he's a former Hanus, a GDL
Jew. He's also a yeshiva booker. Unlike Marty, he had a religious education.
Yeah, and like, you know, if that's your sense, like, you know, that you have to have like some sort of background of that nature to be that kind of scrappy, tough, authentic person. Well, you know, like there's a kind of, you know, there's ways of looking at Kahanism that are like, I think, much more critical than anything that Leon Wieseltier is capable of. In any case, I will save that for a future discussion. But I want to thank David Kleon for
we finally did this one.
A great conversation where I was able to download like all the kind of passionate stuff that got taken out of my already very long review.
Shout out to David Marcus, our mutual editor, who's a good, if sometimes stern, judge of what belongs and what doesn't.
Thank you, David.
Great talking to you, Jay.